Everybody, we are so glad you are back with us, and I want to give a quick shout out to our St. John's campus. Hi, everybody. They are joining us via video today, as well as I am up in Spring Hill Camp for a winter retreat with some of our youth, and hopefully we're having a great time, and I'm not going to come back with a broken leg. So we have just started a series called Better Decisions and Fewer Regrets, and I want to start by sharing a conversation that my husband and I had here in the last couple weeks. So we're both at home. He's gotten off work. He's doing a couple tasks around the house. And I'm actually at home working on this sermon. And we start texting one another because that's what we do in my house. And it's about 4:00. And we're going to put it on the screen so you can enjoy this conversation. Scott texts me, says, "Do you have a dinner plan?" And I'm like, "Well, I do for tomorrow, potato soup. But tonight, yeah, no." And thoughts on dinner? I hate adulting. To which he responds, "Well, I'll go get, just tell me where," which is not at all what I was hoping he would do. So then I'm like, "Well, Applebee's?" And I love his response. He says, "You have to choose and I get, or I choose and you get, we will split the adulting." Can any of you relate? Do any of you struggle with adulting? I don't think it's that we can't make decisions. We're not indecisive. We've made decisions, right? I got dinner for tomorrow. He's made the decision that this is how we're going to attack the problem. It's just that we can't seem to decide the thing that needs to be decided. And there's actually a name for this. It's called decision fatigue. The American Medical Association says it's the idea that after making many decisions, your ability to make more and more decisions as the day goes on gets worse. One psychiatrist has apparently counted up and says, if you add up all the decisions you make, when you're going to get up, how many times you're going to hit the snooze alarm, what you're going to wear, when you brush your teeth, what you eat for breakfast, the route you take to work, what emails you respond to, what emails you ignore, you add up all of those decisions, you're going to make over 35,000 decisions in a day. And no wonder you're tired. And that explains why I can eat healthy all day. But then when I get home and I'm going to decide to eat a really good, healthy snack, ate half a bag of powdered donuts. Don't judge me. You do it too. Then you add in the pandemic, right? And one article I read this week said that our decisions have become more complicated and more contemplative. In other words, we have more decisions to make, they're more complex, and we have more information coming at us that we have to sift through and think about the ramifications of those choices. It's exhausting and it's overwhelming. And that's just day-to-day decisions. Like, we haven't even discussed the big decisions that you have to make in a year or in a lifetime. Who are you going to marry? Are you going to get married? Are you going to buy or rent? Can you afford to buy? Do you go to college? Do you go to trade school? Do you not go at all? How many activities do you let your kids get involved in? At what point is it helpful and what point is it harmful? And then there's the decisions that you didn't plan for, that you didn't anticipate, and they spring up on you. And then you can add to that all those little decisions that we make that seem somewhat insignificant, but then end up having consequences that we didn't imagine. So no wonder we have decision fatigue. It's exhausting and it's overwhelming, and it would be nice to just go and hide away for a little bit. But we can't. We can't avoid making decisions, and we can't avoid the impact that our decisions are going to have on our lives and the lives of those around us. But what we can do is try to make better decisions, because the better decision we make, that's going to be good for everyone. So how do we do that? That's what we're trying to answer. And specifically, as Christ followers, we want to answer, how do we do this in a way that is both whole, right? This idea of completeness, wholeness, soundness, that's healthy, and holy, righteous, and good, that reflects God. And so we looked last week at Proverbs 27:12, and we're going to throw it up on the screen, and I want to encourage you to memorize it with us. But for today, let's say it together. It says, "A prudent person foresees danger and takes precautions. The simpleton goes blindly on and suffers the consequences." So this wise person, they're aware. They see what's on around them. They choose the long-term results and not the short-term, and make appropriate decisions. And that's in comparison to the naive, the simple one who is either unaware or just chooses the short-term payoff over the long-term results, and then they end up regretting it. A And unfortunately, it's not just them that end up regretting it. Many of us end up suffering because of the decisions of other people. And so what we're trying to get at is, how do we become what Proverbs writer calls a prudent person? And we said that last week that the key to this is asking questions before we make decisions, when we're in the middle of making decisions. And we want to ask questions that we can use on the fly and use ahead of time. And this whole question thing is something God has done throughout the Bible. He's asked questions of humans. It's something we see Jesus do in the Gospels. People come to Jesus with questions, and he does one of two things, really a lot. He either asks questions, that's how he answers, or he tells them a parable or a story that actually invites them to ask more questions about themselves. But it's not just any questions we want to ask. We want to ask good questions. I mean, that's part of what made Jesus' questions so powerful, is that they cut down, they went way beyond the surface, and they went to our intentions and our motives and our fears and our desires. It's the quality of the question that makes the difference. And so the better that question we ask, the better decision that we can make. Better questions lead to better decisions. And this checks out in my own life, and I'm going to guess it checks out in your own life. I can look back in hindsight and say, if I knew what I knew now, not only would I probably not have made that decision, but I would have asked myself different questions. Maybe I would have made the same decision, but I would have asked other questions that would have better prepared me for where that decision took me. And so that's our goal over the next 5 weeks, to look at one question a week that we believe is going to help us be what Proverbs 27 says, to be a prudent or wise person, to not be what one translation calls stupid and just keep going right into trouble. So without further ado, the first question is, and we're putting it up on the screen, the integrity question. Now, before I give you what that question is, I actually want to tell you about some specific dudes in the Bible who refused to listen to wise counsel, refused to hear the advice of others. And I want us to consider, how does that happen? How does a person get themselves into a situation where they just will not listen, where they will not make what appears to be the obvious good decision? And we know this happens, this whole not listening. You know of people who have refused counsel from trustworthy people. You and I have probably ignored the advice, good advice, from trustworthy people. So how do we get there? And what we're going to see is that this isn't a modern problem. This is actually an ancient one. So go with me back to the past. About 600 years before Jesus is born, there is this guy named Jeremiah. And Jeremiah is a prophet. And the best way, I think, to describe the role of a prophet is he was like the early warning system for the health of a nation. He would kind of be able to see what was happening in the nation politically, spiritually, relationally, economically, and he could see storms that were going to be on the horizon, and God would lead him, and he would talk to the people of the nation as well as to the leaders. And so Jeremiah serves under several kings, right in a row, actually, who fail to pay attention to his advice. He is sounding like a tornado siren at their door, and they just ignore him. He lived in what is called the Kingdom of Judea, and he began to rule under this king whose name I cannot say, so we're just going to call him King A, because I don't want to butcher his name. And this king was pretty much a teenager when he came to rule. And when he came to rule, Judah was paying financial tribute to Babylon. It's a larger kingdom, and Babylon would send military support to Judah. Judah would send military support to Babylon. And Babylon said, because of this arrangement and this agreement, I will let you rule yourself rather than conquering you and ruling everything. So after about 3 years of this, the king decides, well, he's had enough. He's not going to do this anymore. And he just stops paying the tribute to Babylon. And if that wasn't problematic enough, he decides that he is going to give his allegiance to Egypt. And Egypt and Babylon are enemies. So Jeremiah hears about this decision, and he's like, that's not good. And he goes to the king, and he tells the king. Now, you may be wondering, why is this so bad? Well, to help you understand why this is so bad, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the king of Babylon. His name is King Nebuchadnezzar. And to give you a really good idea about who he is, the kind of quality of person, we're going to talk about one of his hobbies. He collected kings, literally. So he would go into a territory, and he would conquer that territory. And rather than kill the king as a sign of victory, he would actually take that king back all the way to Babylon, put them in prison. And then when he would have a party or a special occasion, he would bring all of the kings that he had conquered out and parade them around all of his guests. And so they would come out in chains, and the kings would put their hand on the king in front of them because they needed that king to help lead them, because not only did he collect the kings, not only did he imprison them, but King Nebuchadnezzar would blind all of those kings. It's a really lovely guy. So Jeremiah's right to be concerned, to think that this might not go well for the king, and if it doesn't go well for the king, it's probably not going to go well for the people of Judah. And so Jeremiah tells the king, like, this is not a good idea, and not only is it not a good idea, but God thinks it's kind of stupid, and God doesn't want you to do it. So not only if you do this are you making a bad decision, but you're disobeying God. But hey, the king is the king, right? He doesn't have to listen to anybody, and so he doesn't. And sure enough, here comes King Nebuchadnezzar with all of his army, and over the course of several months, defeats Judah and takes this king captive back to Babylon, imprisons him, and puts his eyes out. Now, before Nebuchadnezzar leaves, he decides he's going to put the king's son in as the new king. Okay, great. Now, this king, the king's son, is pretty young, too. He's only 18 years old, and he starts to rule. But he doesn't get to rule very long because, for whatever reason, when King Nebuchadnezzar gets back to Babylon and gets settled in, he has a change of heart. And so he actually comes back and he takes this king, the king, original king's son, and takes him back to Babylon to belong to his collection of kings. But I don't want you to worry. King Nebuchadnezzar goes ahead and sets up another king. He puts up the last king's uncle. Are you following this? And this king is also pretty young. And I know you're going to be shocked by this. Guess what this king doesn't do? He doesn't listen to Jeremiah either, right? And it's not only Jeremiah he doesn't listen to. This king has another prophet who comes to him, gives him really good but stern advice, and this king slaps the prophet in the face. And scripture tells us not only does this king continue to make dumb decisions, he does evil in the sight of God, and he too rebels against King Nebuchadnezzar. So Jeremiah, at this point, he's just like, what do you do? No one's listening. And this is not going to end well. And the people are going to be hurt. And so he takes to the streets. And he begins to tell the people of Jerusalem, like, here's what's happening. And here's what's going to happen. And, you know, this isn't okay. And as you can imagine, the king's not happy about that. So he says, well, we got to shut up Jeremiah. So he throws him into a dry cistern, which is going to solve the problem, right? But it's not. Because just like Jeremiah said was going to happen, here comes King Nebuchadnezzar, and they surround the city, and basically, they starve out. They're going to starve out the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And so when this begins to happen, the king is like, oh, okay, well, maybe Jeremiah knew what he was talking about. And so he gets Jeremiah, and he brings Jeremiah to him, and he's like, you've got to ask God to save us. And Jeremiah's like, yeah, dude, you're too late for that. The best chance you have at survival, the best chance for peace that your people have, is to let King Nebuchadnezzar in and beg for mercy. But the king, he's not stupid. He gets, he probably would get mercy for his people, but he's probably not going to get mercy for himself. And so despite Jeremiah's advice, despite the fact that Jeremiah's been right multiple times now, he decides that he's going to take matters in his own hand, and he's going to abandon his people. He gets his bodyguard, his family, and they try to escape out into the night. And they're not successful. Eventually, this king is forced to watch soldiers kill his own family, all of his children. And it is the last thing that this king sees, because his eyes are put out, and he is taken back to Babylon, where he will join the collection of King Nebuchadnezzar's kings. Now, this is a really gruesome story. And it is brutal, really. But when you hear it, I think you've got to wonder, why did none of these kings stop and listen to Jeremiah? And Jeremiah actually offers a reason for us. He writes in Jeremiah 17, verse 9, he says that the heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. Who can understand it? What is Jeremiah saying here? What has he observed? That the human heart is great at lying to itself? Yeah, but I think it's more than that. And I actually think it's a really cool and keen observation. It's not so much that the heart lies, as it is that the heart deceives. We humans aren't, believe it or not, stupid. And so we are usually smart enough to recognize a lie. And so our heart tends to not operate in lies, but in deceit. So it tells us half-truth. It tells us these pleasant-sounding justifications that lull us into thinking that the decision that we are making is good or wise, or, well, it's at least fair or expected. Essentially, you and I are really good at selling ourselves on bad ideas and bad decisions. And these kings had done this. They had somehow managed to convince themselves that they were going to be okay. They could handle King Nebuchadnezzar, or that the consequences that would come would not be that bad. They would at least escape them. They thought their decisions were rational, justified. And I mean, can you blame them? King Nebuchadnezzar is no saint. And yet, they were wrong. They sold themselves on an idea that was bad politically, spiritually, and it was bad for them personally, and it was bad for their entire city. And Jeremiah is not the only one to note this interesting thing about human heart. The propensity to convince ourselves that our bad decision is a good one. That our decision that is morally okay is fine, even if it's not loving. That our wise decision that really isn't all that wise is still a smart one. There's a guy by the name of Francis Bacon. He lived in the 1600s. He was a philosopher and a statesman, and he says this: "The human understanding, when it has once adopted an opinion, draws all things to support and agree with it. And though there'd be a greater number and weight of instances to be found on the other side, yet it either neglects these or despises, or else by some distinction sets it aside and rejects it." Okay, so to put that in a little bit more modern English, Francis Bacon is saying that we humans have opinions, and we will go out of our way to find all of the supporting evidence that agrees with us. And it doesn't matter if there is other good information out there that's telling us that we're wrong. It doesn't matter if there is an overwhelming amount of information that contradicts us. We will convince ourselves that we are right, and that other information, for whatever reason, is wrong, and we don't need to follow it. We don't need to just consider it. And before you get too cocky and you start thinking, well, this only applies to those certain type of people or them over there, this is a you problem. This is a me problem. This is an us problem. Jeremiah is telling us with this verse, this is a human problem. Now, this verse has actually been used at times in the church, this idea that our hearts are deceitful in ways that are unhealthy, that have been manipulative, and I think in ways that Jeremiah probably didn't mean. So how do we get at what Jeremiah is saying? Well, I don't think that Jeremiah is saying that we are to ignore our feelings or that our hearts are just thoroughly bad with nothing at all good in them, because to do that is to negate or erase the image of God. And I don't think he's suggesting that we shouldn't trust the kind of our gut instincts or our critical thinking. God gave us a critical mind. He wants us to use it. And we know that the Spirit speaks to men and women, and sometimes that feels like a gut instinct. I don't think Jeremiah is advocating that we give away our autonomy, our ability to make decisions, and let other people make decisions for us, right? The goal isn't to set my brain aside and let others think for me because my heart's just, you know, corrupt and unreliable. So again, what is Jeremiah getting at? Well, I think to understand that, we've got to get at what Jeremiah's culture was. How would they have understood this word heart? Because we think of it as feelings, desires. But in the ancient Near Eastern culture, the heart was thought to be the center of a person's emotions, as well as the home of their intellect and the center of their inner life. The Hebrew word for heart refers not only to impulse and intuition, but also to reason and will. Amy Jill Levine writes in the Jewish Annotated New Testament that the heart represents the center of thought and conviction. As another writer that I read recently put it, the ancients knew intuitively what the latest research concedes as fact. We just aren't as rational as we like to think. The human propensity to see what we want to see, believe what we already believe, that Francis Bacon notes, that Jeremiah records thousands of years before, is what you and I would call today in 2022 confirmation bias. We're naturally open to anything that confirms what we already think and what we already want to do. And we do what Francis Bacon says almost without thinking. We are able to set aside or reject anything that is to the contrary of what we think or want to do. And we do this because our hearts, the place where our reason and our will, as well as our emotions reside, that inner person of who we really are, is just really good at selling us what we want, and usually at a price. I think, in short, if we were to sum it up, we're saying that Scripture says this, and human experience confirms this, and science confirms it. The easiest person to deceive is the person that's in the mirror. And when we deceive ourselves, we make poor decisions. We end up making decisions that make life difficult for us, that hurt other people, people that we didn't even want to hurt. So what do? If we don't want to deceive ourselves, right? But we're not supposed to give up our decision-making power. How do we guard against kind of the self-delusion? How do we guard against the used car salesperson in our head? We start by asking the integrity question, which is simply this: am I being honest with myself? What do I mean by that? Well, I'm going to walk through some real examples that you may have run into at some point in your life, or you may yet, and I'm going to add a little word at the end. And I encourage you, when you ask this question, to ask it in the speed and tone with which I'm going to ask these questions. Why do you continue to date the person you're dating? Really? Why are you taking or quitting that job? Really? Why did you file for divorce or refuse to go to counseling? Really? What's the real reason that you are not talking to your child, your parents, your sibling, a coworker? Really? Why won't you tell people the truth about what's going on? Really? Why'd you make that last purchase? Really? Why are you not forgiving that person completely? Really? Why are you continuing to gossip about that other person? Really? When we ask ourselves this question and we answer it honestly, I think it can be terrifying. And I also think it can be clarifying. We make decisions so often that aren't necessarily wrong, but they're not good. They don't line up with who we want to be, our values. They don't line up with what Christ is trying to do in our life and in the world. And we get there because we aren't honest with ourselves. So, you know, we took that job and we convinced ourselves that we were taking that job because we needed this position or this amount of money so that we could provide for our family. But if we were honest, we took that job because somewhere along the line, we had convinced or learned that our self-value is rooted in the stuff we own, the money we can make, our status or our privilege. We told ourselves that we took this job or this promotion or we worked this way for our family, but it was really for us. And there is nothing wrong with succeeding and having stuff and making money. It's just that that has become our goal. And if we aren't honest about why we did this, this one decision ends up like snowballing into a bunch of other bad decisions. So we're going to be more likely now to not set good boundaries with coworkers. We aren't going to take time off with our family. We are going to work more and more hours, hurting our physical health, hurting our emotional and mental health, losing the connection we have with our family. And we'll do this all the while saying we're doing this for our family. And what happens is we sacrifice the very people that we have convinced ourselves that we are doing it for because we just aren't honest with why we took this job to begin with. And that's just one example. We could spend quite a bit of time going through example after example. We're dating this person not so much because we care for them, but we don't want to be alone, which is completely understandable. We don't mean to be using this person, but we're terrified, and so we've convinced ourselves that we feel things that we don't feel. We bought that last purchase that we are convinced we're going to use, it's going to help us, it's going to save us money, and it may do all of those things. But we bought it because we were bored or depressed or trying to avoid a problem or to impress someone else. And what makes us even more trickier is that sometimes we can still make the right decision while spinning ourselves a lie. But that's why this question is still so beneficial. We need to ask it, because if we will ask it, we will prevent ourselves tomorrow from making a decision based on a past decision, because we'll have stopped kind of the cycle. And you could be thinking, well, I've already made a bad decision, Jessica. Anything to do about it now? I can't change it. And you're probably right. But by asking this question, you can at least help yourself make some better decisions now that you are where you are. I think back to those three kings, and I think if they had just asked, what was the real reason they were doing what they were doing? What was the real reason that they refused to listen to Jeremiah? Did they think he wasn't good enough? Did they have a point to prove? Did they want to stick it to the bad guy? Did they want to prove that they were just as strong and as good? Was it self-preservation? Was it glory? Was it riches? And here's the thing. There were good reasons to reject King Nebuchadnezzar's rule. I mean, seriously, as we saw, that man had issues and was no saint. He was brutal. But if they had asked themselves, why am I insisting on this course of action? Why am I refusing to listen to Jeremiah? They might have been able to make better decisions. They might have figured out how to get out from Nebuchadnezzar's rule. They might have sought God to say, you know, is this even what God wants us to do? And had they done that, we don't know for sure, because there's no guarantee in life, but the chances are they would have made a better decision. And a better decision would have affected the lives of their children and the lives of the people in their community. Because our decisions impact others. Just as we get decision fatigue, but we can't avoid decisions, we cannot avoid the result of our behavior affecting other people. And so the questions that we are willing to ask ourselves matter, because our decisions will impact others. And there's another reason that I think it's so important to ask ourselves this question if you are someone who has chosen to follow Christ. And it's this: we serve a God who functions in reality. That is what the incarnation, Jesus coming to earth as a baby, shows us. God shows up in the world as it is, to people as they are, and he works through those circumstances, those personalities, and those issues. God is not a God that deals with illusions. God comes to shatter our illusions, to love us as we are, and to transform us where we are. And when I am honest with myself about why I am doing what I'm doing, about why I want what I want, it is going to set me up to hear God's Spirit, who can then lead me forward to more love, more grace, more wisdom, things that are all going to empower me to make better decisions. And when I can make better decisions because I've been honest about who I am and why I'm doing what I'm doing, my better decisions will also end up being whole, healthy, complete, and holy. Now, just like last week, we sent you out with some homework, so to speak. We want to challenge you with some homework this week as well. We want to encourage you once again to begin to memorize Proverbs 27:12. And again, this is one version. I'm learning it in another version that says, don't be stupid, because I need that harsh of a reminder. So pick a version you like that speaks to you and begin to memorize this. And then we want you to answer two questions. And we want you to do this in community with somebody. The first is to find someone and share together about your last significant decision. And honestly, what was behind that decision? Why did you make that decision really? And then we want you to ask yourself this, and again, share this with someone. In what current circumstance, relationship, decision, do you need to stop and ask yourself, am I being honest with myself? Really? All right, that is question number one, and we are looking forward to next week. Pastor Wes is going to be here, and he is going to walk us through the legacy question. And so we're really looking forward to that question as well. And before we go, would you pray with me? God, we thank you. that you love us and that you come to us as we are, where we're at. Lord, I just ask that as we have listened to the story about these kings who just refused to be honest with themselves and to consider these questions, that we would take that to heart and that we would stop and ask ourselves honestly. Help us to remember that we do this in the context of love and grace and empowerment. We need not feel ashamed because we get down to the honest answer and it's not pretty. From there, Lord, you can begin to equip us and empower us and help us to make better decisions. And others' lives will be impacted as well. We thank you that you are going to stick with us. You stick closer than a friend. You will never leave us nor forsake us. In your name we pray, and wherever you're at, amen.